If you like Area 45, you're going to enjoy the Hoover Institution's other podcasts, Uncommon Knowledge, The Classicist with Victor Davis Hanson, and The Libertarian with Richard Epstein. Subscribe now to the Hoover Podcast at hoover.org/podcasts. That's hoover.org/podcasts. Hoover Podcast, ideas defining a free society. Hello, it's Monday, March the 11th, and welcome to Area 45, a Hoover Institution podcast examining the policy avenues available to the 45th President of the United States. I'm Bill Whalen, the Hoover Institution's Virginia Hobbs Carpenter Fellow in Journalism. Joining me today in our studio here on the campus of Stanford University is Adam White. Adam's a Hoover Research Fellow based in the nation's capital. He writes frequently on the courts of the administrative state for the Wall Street Journal, Commentary, National Affairs, and other publications. And he's a law professor at George Mason University's Antonin Scalia Law School, where he directs the C. Boyden Gray Center for the Study of the Administrative State. Adam, welcome back to the podcast.
Well, it's always good to be here, Bill.
And later today, you're doing a podcast of your own. Please tell me what it is.
Well, I do this podcast with Richard Epstein called Reasonable Disagreements, where I try to be very reasonable, and then he disagrees with me. We're taping, actually, it's going to be later this week, and one never knows quite what the subject is going to be. We always respond to whatever the latest events of the day are, trying to find an interesting disagreement and discussion from a conservative versus libertarian perspective.
Do us a favor and try to get Richard to come out of his shell.
Yeah, right. Right. He's usually so reticent.
So shy and retiring.
Right.
He is about the ideal podcast guest because he does not hold back on his opinions and he'll go at length.
Well, that's why I think he has three podcasts right now.
We'll have fun with that later on today. So, Adam, this week ends in the Ides of March, and back in Washington, it seems like a few Republican senators have it in for their Caesar. What I'm talking about is a likely Senate vote to block the president's emergency declaration at the U.S.-Mexico border. So the question is, what's motivating these renegade senators, Adam? And I'm going to give you three categories to play with here. One is, and they're all P's. The first P is precedent. There are Republican senators who fear that if you allow the Republican president to do this, nothing holding back the Democratic president from doing this on, let's say, climate change. Second P is pork. There are senators who simply don't like the president going into the budget and taking away money from perhaps their projects to go into his border wall. And the third one, Adam, is piety, which is the one I think I want you to focus on, and that's the Constitution and executive powers.
See, I thought one of them was going to be principal, although we're talking about Congress,
Adam.
That's right. I think you're right to break it down into a few categories. There's a number of reasons why Republican senators might vote against President Trump's emergency declaration. They might simply disagree with him on the facts on the ground, although as senators, they're probably less well-positioned to analyze the facts than President Trump, who has the entire administrative apparatus to sort of investigate things on the ground. I do think, though, some Republicans are generally concerned about the breadth of power that's given to the president by these prior statutes administered by Congress. Right. President Trump isn't making this declaration, these emergency powers, up out of thin air. These are all statutes that Congress passed in the past. In the 1970s, there was another statute, the Emergencies Act, which sort of creates a procedure for invoking these statutes. But President Trump is using powers that were delegated to him by Congress. There's two questions. One is, are the facts on the ground really sufficient to justify triggering these powers? But second, a number of senators just have qualms with the breadth of powers. Senators Mike Lee, Rand Paul, and others have raised questions about whether it's good for presidents to be able to just flip like a light switch these immense powers to reprogram funds away from certain military infrastructure projects or priorities over to this border wall.
Let me throw a fourth P into this conversation, and that is Pelosi.
Pelosi.
As in House Speaker Nancy Pelosi, who said the following, Adam, quote, "This is plainly a power grab by a disappointed president who has gone outside the bounds of the law to try to get what he failed to achieve in the constitutional legislative process." Professor White, agree or disagree?
Well, let's remind Speaker Pelosi of two other P's, pen and phone. These are not...
This is Barack Obama's comment, right?
Right. In many ways, one of the reasons why Republicans are somewhat critical of President Trump on this is that there's a worry that President Trump might now sort of venture down the same path that President Obama did in his own presidency when he was being thwarted by Congress. Right. And Congress wasn't giving President Obama what he wanted. He started to govern unilaterally, primarily through executive orders, on things ranging from immigration, of course, to other domestic policies like energy and environmental regulation. And so I think people ought to remind Speaker Pelosi that in many ways what President Trump is doing here seems to be of a kind with what her own preferred president, President Obama, did for so long. But that gets back to the precedent question, presidents and precedents. In this case, there is some concern that if President Trump goes forward or is allowed to go forward with this program, that he's opening the door to even more radical action by the next Democratic president. And in fact, Democrats didn't hesitate to sort of shout that from the rooftops when President Trump made his emergency declaration. They said this is the kind of thing that could be used in the future if a president, a Democratic president, were to declare a climate emergency or a gun emergency. Now, those arguments really miss the point. It's not that a president can just declare a declaration and then do whatever he wants. It all has to come back to these statutes that grant the president with particular powers. And it's not obvious that there's a lot of room for climate policy under this. And I tried to sketch that out in a recent piece for Commentary Magazine. But it's also worth considering that so much of the Democratic agenda for the previous eight-year presidency really was a governor, was sort of governing by emergency.
Right.
Remember Rahm Emanuel's famous line, don't let a crisis go to waste?
Right.
And even in subtler ways, the Obama administration, especially on climate policy, was always trying to wrap up their policies in terms of the urgency of emergency. And so in many ways, the worry is that President Trump is just reiterating and reiterating and exacerbating the entire sort of crisis mindset of modern governance, that nothing gets through legislation anymore, and so it's up to the president to try to usher things through unilaterally, arguing that we don't have time, that there's a fierce urgency of now on all manner of domestic policy.
So Congress, the government has declared, the presidents have declared 58 emergencies going back to 1979.
Right.
Most of them have gone away. They've not been, Congress does have to extend them.
Right.
I think after, what, a five-year period?
I think it varies.
Yeah, something
sure.
like that, yeah. And a few are still on the books. I think we still have some emergencies with relation to Iran, for example, Iranian oil and things like that. Most have gone away. But there is a big advantage that the executive holds in this, and that if, and we're seeing this playing out, and that if he is rebuffed by the Democratic House, as expected, and then the Republican Senate rebuffs him as well, that's politically embarrassing. But he then vetoes the measure, the resolution, and they can't override it.
Right.
And or at least they will most likely not come up with two-thirds majorities to override.
Right. And in that respect, as you point out, what President Trump is doing is well precedented in terms of, you know, the sheer number of emergency declarations that have been used in the past.
Right.
Well, I think, though, it's important to keep in mind that what President Trump is trying to accomplish here with the border wall, it just in some ways feels different. Right. This is his signature policy, one that's been debated for the first 2 years of his presidency. Congress, for a variety of reasons, ranging from just disagreement to the procedural block of the filibuster and the basic crisis in our budget process in general, Congress hasn't delivered what he wanted. And for a president to take the emergency power statutes and use them to trigger his own power to move forward unilaterally on such an immensely important issue. I think everybody in these debates, whether you agree with President Trump or disagree on the merits of the wall, everybody would agree that this is an extremely important national policy.
Correct.
And so to have a policy of that magnitude and national importance decided unilaterally through the emergency power, I think that sets it apart from a lot of the emergency declarations. I won't say all past emergency declarations. We've had extremely consequential ones, especially in the aftermath of 9/11. But there is this unease, and I share it too, about using the emergency power statutes not as sort of an exceptional doctrine for small matters, but using it as the main tool of rulemaking, or sorry, of presidential action, of lawmaking. Now, that's a little worrisome.
So Congress fails to override the veto. Now let's talk a bit about the legal process that occurs after this. It's not like the issue goes away.
Right.
Somebody will sue the president to stop this.
Right.
Is it a member of Congress, Adam? Is it a concerned group of citizens? And when you sue the executive branch of the government to stop this from happening, Where do you go shopping for that? Do you go to the DCA? Do you start the process in Washington? Do you go to South Texas? Do you go looking around the country for what I assume would be a friendly district court and a friendly appellate court? What's your sense of how that'll play out?
Right. Well, in Democracy in America back in the 1830s, Tocqueville said that there's scarcely a political issue in this country that doesn't become eventually a judicial question.
Right.
And some things never change.
Right.
Now more than ever, it's clear that these issues will go to court. So once we'll wait for the Senate to vote. We'll wait for the president to veto the Senate if it votes in favor of opposing his emergency action. This can't just go to court without somebody being injured by it. Mm-hmm. There's a doctrine called standing. It's a basic rule of the federal courts. It's rooted in the Constitution's limited role for the judiciary that you can't file a federal lawsuit, especially against the federal government,
right,
unless you actually have standing, unless you're injured by the federal action that you're complaining of. And so I'm sure some members of Congress will sue. It's always been sort of dubious whether members of Congress have power, have standing to sue over separation of powers issues. This came up a little bit in the last administration when there were lawsuits by members of the House of Representatives over some of President Obama's spending, his use of funds. That was never fully litigated, and so it's unclear whether members of Congress really have standing here. I'd say the most likely people to sue will be landowners whose land is impacted on the border by this new wall.
Would they do eminent domain, or?
Yeah, if it's right. It could be a couple of things, but primarily if the government tries to take their land or take their land through eminent domain, mm-hmm, or cross their land or do something else that would have impacts.
Couldn't you also see environmental groups do endangered species files, let's say, or something like that?
Yeah,
there's just all kinds of ways just to trip up the process.
Yeah, you know? That's right. Now, environmental groups, they have to have standing too, so right, they would have to have members who are directly impacted, maybe not landowners, but people who say, you know, I visit this area because of particular, I study or work with particular endangered species. Mm-hmm. I think for a variety of reasons, it's the private landowners,
right,
that are probably the most politically salient plaintiffs. This is something that the left discovered through the fights over Keystone XL pipeline and other things. I was writing about this back in 2012 a bit, actually, on the intersection of energy infrastructure policy and private land owning, mm-hmm, private landowners. And especially, you know, conservatives have always been wary of the use of eminent domain very protective of property rights. That was less a progressive priority, but as other efforts to block the Keystone pipeline really sort of slowed, they were ineffectual. The left picked up on the importance of private landowners in these infrastructure fights. And so I think you'll see a similar thing here, where landowners who are directly impacted or who are likely to be impacted by the building of the wall will be identified by liberal groups behind the scenes.
Mm-hmm.
Those groups will organize one or more landowners to file a lawsuit. That lawsuit could be filed in one of two places. It could either be filed at the federal district court where the harm occurs, so a
right,
Texas district court. Or since the federal government resides in Washington, D.C., they could file it here. This is always a bit of strategery, so to speak, on the side of plaintiffs, and I engaged in it too back when I was in private practice, trying to identify which venue has the best, most sympathetic judges, most sympathetic body of precedents.
Right.
The fact is, now that the U.S. Court of Appeals for the D.C. Circuit is a majority Democrat court, after President Obama and Harry Reid stacked it with a number of appointees,
mm-hmm,
it's possible the case would be filed here. To the extent that the border wall, these segments that will be built now are in California, obviously that's where they would want to go first and foremost. But to the extent that this wall is being focused on the Texas border, plaintiffs will have a hard choice between federal courts in Texas and federal courts in Washington.
Well, I think Trump said, just watch and see, the Ninth Circuit will overturn this. But was he being serious or facetious?
Well, that's where ideally they'd file. And they could find an environmental group that has members in California and in Texas. Maybe it could be filed in California.
Mm-hmm.
There's a reason why so many of these cases are being filed in California courts, whereas during the Obama years, so many cases were filed in federal courts in and around Texas.
Mm-hmm.
It's just the basic ideological makeup of the two courts.
And to clarify, Adam, Texas state government's run by Republicans. There's a Republican attorney general, Republican governor, so you'll not see the state of Texas involved in the suit. It would be some other entity. times.
Yeah, I imagine the state of Texas, its attorney general and right. a number of red state attorneys general right. will try to get involved in the case through right. amicus briefs, friend of the court briefs,
right.
in favor of the administration. And we'll see a lineup of blue state attorneys general
right.
Filing briefs against the policy, definitely.
Right, we're in California. I can tell you that if California had a shot at this, the governor, Gavin Newsom, the attorney general, Javier Becerra, they'd be tripping each other on the race to the courthouse to file the papers first.
Oh, yeah, and just to be clear here, like a lottery, the old saying, you can't win if you don't play.
Right.
Of course, the California attorney general is going to file a lawsuit. Mm-hmm. Now, the question of whether that lawsuit will overcome a motion to dismiss for lack of standing is another question.
Yeah.
But, of course, the California attorney general will file a lawsuit.
I think he's only filed about 50 against the president, by the way, so.
Right, right. Well, you know, when you love what you do, you never work a day in your life, and he obviously loves to sue the president.
What if it's like one of those punch-out cards you get at Starbucks after 10 lawsuits, you get a
right.
free will at LegalZoom or something
right,
like
frequent,
that.
Right, a frequent filer card.
Okay. Yeah. What are the odds that this makes it to the U.S. Supreme Court?
Oh, I'd say pretty high.
Because it's a kind of matter the court has to weigh on to.
Right. It becomes pretty high if the initial district court issues an injunction blocking the project.
Right.
That and, you know, nationwide injunctions and injunctions by one federal district court against a major federal policy, they become more and more prevalent,
mm-hmm.
Raising the stakes. I think that makes it much more likely to go to the Supreme Court. But the court has tended to allow a lot of these issues to kind of percolate. They've rebuffed efforts to fast-track cases up to the Supreme Court.
Mm-hmm.
So it'll be interesting, and that's something we can talk about later, you know, the role of the court in overseeing these disputes.
Right.
But along the way, by the way, before you even get to the Supreme Court, there will be interesting questions about the amount of deference that lower courts, including the lower courts of appeals, give to the president's interpretation of the law and mm-hmm. interpretation of the facts. One of the things that President Trump, his administration, and his advocates and supporters are really banking on is the courts giving the usual amount of deference that presidents get on matters of national security. And that may well be how things turn out. But again, where this really is a policy, a controversial policy, one that the president himself has sort of said either intentionally or inadvertently is in some ways an emergency of his own choosing. You know, he said mm-hmm. when he declared the emergency that he didn't have to do this right now. He sort of chose to do it. President Trump, the downside of him saying, one of the downsides of him saying so much is that he oftentimes offers ammunition to the other side mm-hmm. to explain in court why general doctrines of deference and so on really shouldn't apply to this given presidential action. You know, I said in Commentary magazine on their website a little while ago, these presidential powers, I think they tend to embody the basic presumption by Congress and the public that there are times when presidents have to take extraordinary action, but they're sort of premised upon sort of the usual conventions of the presidency. And President Trump obviously came to office by flouting convention, by saying he wasn't going to be like the usual Washington politicians.
Mm-hmm.
Well, these emergency statutes were written for usual Washington politicians in the form of the presidency. I think it'd be very interesting to watch how the Supreme Court especially grapples with these conventions when you have such an unconventional president.
Thank you for the setup, because let's talk about the court now. Let's talk in particular about one individual.
Right.
I'm on a plane tomorrow to Washington, Adam. I've spent a couple of days in the Hoover, D.C. office. And if I were to go to D.C. right now and pay respects to the most influential person in town, I don't think I'd go to the White House. And I don't think I'd go to Capitol Hill and say hi to Speaker Pelosi or Leader McConnell. Right. I think I'd go to the Supreme Court, Adam, and say hello to the Chief Justice. And here's why. John Roberts. A little background of Chief Justice Roberts, Adam. So he is 64 years old. He has been the Chief Justice since September of 2005. How many Chief Justices have there been in our 200, almost 30 years of this?
Oh, gosh, I should know this. It's about a dozen.
17.
Ha!
How many managers did George Steinbrenner go through in his 25 years with the New York Yankees?
Please tell me it's 17.
22. This is not a commonly held job. Now, Roberts first became the Chief Justice in September 2005, so he is approaching his 14-year mark. And let's do a little math here for a second.
Yeah.
He's 64 years, as I mentioned. Let's say he does it for another 14 years,
mm-hmm.
up to 78. Right. He's now looking at some serious history.
Right.
The longest-serving Chief Justice was John Marshall.
Right.
Right. 34 years, 1801 to 1835. Second longest-serving Chief Justice, Roger Taney.
Yeah.
Right. 28 years ending in 1864. Rehnquist held it for almost 19 years. Only seven chief justices have held the job longer than Roberts. So, Adam, 14 years into the job, he is maybe at the halfway mark. So I think it's a good time to look at legacy,
yeah.
but also look at this question. what has happened to John Roberts over the past 14 years? Because it's an interesting backstory. Remember, he sort of backs into being the Chief Justice. He is first nominated to replace Sandra Day O'Connor as an Associate Justice. Then Rehnquist passes away, and Bush 43 switches him to Chief Justice.
Right.
So he kind of, in some ways, he's kind of the accidental Chief Justice. Yeah. And the assumption is, holy goodness, here is a real honest-to-gosh conservative on the court. Just, you know, he is a red-blooded, red-meat conservative.
Right.
But that hasn't been the John Roberts of late.
You know, it's I think it's fitting that you point out that he's an accidental Chief Justice. The same could be said of Chief Justice John Marshall,
right,
who wasn't John Adams' pick, and there's a famous story behind about how the job landed in Marshall's lap. And let's return to that in a little bit, because Roberts himself is very cognizant of the precedence of the prior Chief Justices. He's given a lot of speeches on this. I actually wrote one of the favorite pieces I ever wrote for the Weekly Standard was for the 10th anniversary of Roberts on the court, mm-hmm, a long, long sort of reflection upon Roberts' origins and his jurisprudence and so on. You're also right that the Supreme Court, you know, plays such an important role, an outsized role, really, in policy. Sometimes if I'm with a visitor in Washington, D.C., and you're walking down First Street, and on one side of the street is the Supreme Court and the other side is the Capitol building, I like to say to my friends, you know, it's great to be here where on one side you can look in one direction and see where all the laws are made, and then on the other direction you can see the U.S. Capitol.
Where they get adjudicated.
Right. Well, no, you see,
right,
all the laws are made in the Supreme Court.
Laws are passed where they're actually
adjudicated. Right. And Roberts, he's been extremely controversial, primarily because of the way he parted ways with his conservative colleagues twice in major challenges involving Obamacare.
Right.
First, the constitutional challenge to the individual mandate, mm-hmm, and then second, a constitutional challenge to some significant regulations implementing or creating the state and federal insurance exchanges, mm-hmm, and their subsidies. And Roberts departed from the conservatives on those two cases. And now, more recently, and it's gotten a lot of attention, there's a great piece in Bloomberg by Greg Storr recently recounting the ways in which Chief Justice Roberts has departed from his conservative colleagues in some cases involving abortion, the death penalty, and so on.
Asylum policy, yeah.
Yeah, and these cases are complicated because only one of them, the death penalty case, was an actual majority opinion on the merits. The other two are procedural issues, mm-hmm, which always get a little messy, and you hesitate. You should hesitate, at least, to read too much into them.
Right.
But the fact is, Chief Justice Roberts.
Try Lord Overseer.
Right, that's right, Ombudsman for the federal government, John Roberts, parted ways with his four conservative colleagues.
Right, he sticks out like a sore thumb because there are four conservatives and there are four liberals, and he is the fifth vote siding with the liberals. And this is not how it was supposed to be or anticipated.
Right. You know, in my Weekly Standard piece, this again a few years ago for his 10th anniversary, I said maybe the best way to think about Roberts is to think of it as like three sort of nested questions, kind of like Russian nesting dolls.
Yes.
Right. One is the question of Roberts' view of the federal government's role in our country. Mm-hmm. And Roberts seems more sympathetic to federal power than other conservatives are.
Right.
The second question is how Roberts sees the court's role in the federal government. And he's always claimed to be more of the judicial restraint type. He's more active in micromanaging the administrative state. In fact, he's been one of the most vocal critics on the right in the court of the administrative state. But by and large, he sees the court as its proper role being rather deferential to Congress and the executive branch. And then finally, there's the question of the Chief Justice on the court. Mm-hmm. And there, Roberts, with an eye to his predecessors, especially some of the great Chief Justices, Marshall, and Chief Justice Taft, and Rehnquist, for whom Roberts worked before Rehnquist was the chief. Mm-hmm. Roberts really, from the very beginning, from his confirmation hearings, positioned himself as a moderating influence in that he said he preferred broader bipartisan decisions over narrow partisan, ideologically divided decisions. If you can get a 7-2 opinion rather than a 5-4 opinion, by limiting the scope of the decision, making it sort of less a matter of broad ideological principle and making it more a narrower area of consensus, Roberts said he agreed with, he preferred to do that. Mm-hmm. Now, for the most part on his term, he gets beat over the head by the left with that statement because by and large, and I think this is important, by and large, he sided with his conservative colleagues. But there have been moments where Roberts seems to be either just flatly disagreeing with his colleagues or wanting to calibrate the court's work in a way that avoids hot-button political decisions. Mm-hmm. And in some ways, a couple of the orders we've seen recently reflect that. For example, there's a case called Trump versus East Bay Sanctuary Covenant. This was a challenge to the Trump administration's modifications of asylum policy and the procedure by which people from outside the country can seek asylum. That was challenged in federal district court in California. And the federal judge who received the case issued an injunction purporting to prohibit the administration nationwide from implementing that policy. So what happened was the Justice Department sought a fast-track appeal to the Supreme Court, and Roberts sided with the liberals on the court in saying, no, we're not going to block that injunction for now. We're not going to fast-track the appeal. We're going to allow the injunction to stay in place. We're going to allow the issue to percolate up to the Supreme Court. So you look at this and say, okay, maybe Roberts is more sympathetic than the other conservatives on the merits of the case. Another way to look at it is Roberts is just reluctant to have the court race into a case rather than waiting for things to percolate up. Mm-hmm. Now, on the other hand, in another case where he sided with the liberals called June Medical Services versus Gee from March, the court actually granted a motion to block a lower court decision from going into effect. The Fifth Circuit, the federal appeals court covering Texas and Louisiana, had issued a decision affirming Louisiana's new restrictions on abortion. Mm-hmm. These have to do with what we call hospital admitting privileges, where the state tells abortion providers that they are limited or prohibited from providing abortions if their doctors don't have privileges at hospitals. Mm-hmm. Now, the Supreme Court a couple of years ago struck down Texas's own version of this law, and Roberts actually joined the dissent criticizing the Supreme Court. And Roberts joined the conservatives in saying, no, this kind of restriction on abortions is not an undue burden on the right to abortion, which is the current constitutional standard. So Roberts was with the conservatives last time. I look at Roberts joining the liberals in this one as more of Roberts' effort to allow this precedent, one that he disagrees with, to remain in effect while this case is percolating up from Louisiana. Roberts is recognizing that in many ways the Louisiana law looks a lot like the Texas law, mm-hmm. not completely like the Texas law, and Texas's circumstances might differ from Louisiana's circumstances. But I see Roberts here as basically saying, okay, this case is most likely governed by the framework we espoused in the prior case, even though Roberts disagrees with that framework. Right. Let's allow this to play out through a full Supreme Court review before the court takes any action.
So the chief occasionally goes out and gives talks at law schools around the country, and those are interesting to look at because every now and then a little nugget gets out there that's worth examining. So let me read back to you one, Adam. He said in February he was speaking at Belmont Law School in Nashville, Tennessee. And here's what Roberts said, quote, "We are not just another part of the political process. People need to know that we're not doing politics, we being the Supreme Court. Right. They need to know that we're doing something different, that we're applying the law."
Right.
Do you, Adam White, think that the Roberts Court matches his standard that we are applying the law?
See, I thought you were going to read a slightly different quote where Roberts said, in response to President Trump attacking some of the judges who have ruled against him, mm-hmm. you know, Trump, President Trump was denouncing Obama judges.
Yes.
And Roberts made headlines when he said,
"We're not."
Right. Go ahead.
He said, "What? We're not a president.
We're not Trump judges. We're not Obama judges. We're just judges."
Right.
And Roberts, you know, in the past said at his confirmation hearings, judges should be umpires calling the balls and strikes.
Right.
Now, of course, that metaphor isn't perfect.
Right. How often does Ruth Bader Ginsburg stray from?
Right. Everybody understands that there are basic patterns of voting, and of course, Roberts himself has been part of that pattern by and large.
Right.
And that's always been the case, right? Going back to the very beginning of the Supreme Court, everybody mm-hmm. understood the stakes of the case. They understood, the stakes of the court. They understood the stakes of getting Federalist versus Anti-Federalist judges on the court, mm-hmm. or Federalist versus Republican, Democratic, Republican judges on the court. And the shift from Chief Justice Marshall to Chief Justice Taney was extremely consequential.
Right.
We all know this. We also understand at the same time that ideally courts should not act in a partisan way, that courts are different from the other two branches in important ways, and that's a good thing. Even with the umpire metaphor, right? Umpires call balls and strikes, but umpires differ in what the strike zone is.
Correct.
There's plenty of judgment calls in being an umpire. In some ways, Roberts' metaphor is much more nuanced than some of his critics would let on.
Umpires also make makeup calls.
Right, right. That's right. And people like to work the refs.
Right.
Okay, so let's get back to your question, though. Yes. How is the Roberts Court actually...
applying the law.
Applying the law. You know, I'd say, by and large, the conservative judges on the court see themselves as applying the law through the basic framework of originalism. Mm-hmm. Roberts gives a little bit more benefit of the doubt to precedent, to judicial restraint. Even among the conservatives, there's wide variations. Gorsuch isn't the same as Kavanaugh. Kavanaugh isn't the same as Thomas. They all have their own sort of variations in the way they apply a basically originalist framework.
Right.
On the left, and this has been the case ever since the rise of originalism, there really hasn't been a single coherent non-originalist jurisprudence. There's a few different things. It used to be called non-interpretivism. Its critics call it judicial activism. Some people call it the living constitution, and on. But by and large, the liberal justices are pretty consistent in the way they go about their work. So we have the conservatives being very consistent in their approach, liberals being very consistent in their approach, and thus the court being consistently fractured along party lines. Mm-hmm. I do want to say about Roberts' line about Trump judges and Obama judges, a lot of people saw Roberts as, you know, criticizing President Trump and standing up for Obama judges. I think it's a little more subtle than that. I think Chief Justice Roberts, I need some more coffee this morning. Chief Justice Roberts, his comment isn't just a defense right now of so-called Obama judges.
Right.
Roberts' opinion is a preemptive defense of Trump judges. We're going to see whether President Trump serves for 2 more years or 6 more years. There will someday be a Democratic president again. And President Trump's immense work on reforming the judiciary, appointing more judges. And I think President Trump said over the weekend something like, you know, there's 145 vacancies left to be filled, and he wants to fill them all. This president is going to leave behind an unprecedented legacy of judicial appointments,
right,
which is going to have huge ramifications going forward for future Democratic administrations and Democratic policies.
You're talking about filling up district courts and appellate courts. You're talking about men and women who are going to be in these positions for 10, 20, 30 years.
Exactly. Right. And then on the Supreme Court as well. That's why you have now Eric Holder saying that he endorses court packing plans that would restructure the Supreme Court to just add more Democratic seats.
Actually, let me read you a quote from Brian Fallon, who is a former Hillary Clinton spokesman, and this is will get you your...
Yeah.
Hyper quote of the week, but here's what he said the other day. Quote, more and more Democrats are becoming convinced that we cannot resign ourselves to the third branch of government being captive to partisan Republican forces for the next 30 years.
Yeah.
Exhale.
Yeah, it's, you know, for those who always criticize President Trump for not respecting institutions, it's amusing and dismaying, I guess, to watch folks on the left say that they want to radically reform the Supreme Court just because they're upset over the fact that President Trump has gotten to appoint 2 Supreme Court justices, and that Mitch McConnell was able to block a Senate vote was able to marshal the senators to not vote on the Garland nomination. And I wrote about that a lot at the time. I thought criticism of McConnell was overblown. I thought that there was precedent for what he was doing. Of course, it was a controversial action. It was bound to have blowback, and now we're seeing it.
Right.
But from the moment Justice Kennedy announced his retirement this summer, from that very moment, you saw all manner of radical proposals coming from the left, efforts to really delegitimize the Supreme Court. I said at the time in the Weekly Standard, I said it was all the end of Justice Kennedy's Camelot.
Right.
And that suddenly the left was seeing some of their policies, especially on social issues, opened up to Democratic deliberation in a way that Justice Kennedy had protected them on these issues.
Well, Holder wants to add 2 seats, but that's just pure revenge for Trump getting two picks on the court. But right. What else is there? So let's say that there's been talk about term limits for judges.
Yep. And there's something to be said for that, by the way.
Talking about age limits for judges.
Yep.
Right. And then packing or adding justices.
Packing.
Well.
And then, of course, they said, let's impeach. Right. Let's impeach Kavanaugh. And you've seen that die down. But yep. There were calls for impeachment. I think there's just a general tone of delegitimization for the Supreme Court
right.
in the same way that the John Birch Society wanted to delegitimize the Warren Court in the 1960s. There's just a campaign. I think we'll see a campaign of persistent delegitimization. There's a wave of books now coming out.
There's a book on Kavanaugh coming
there's
out.
Books on Kavanaugh books coming out. There's right. going to be a number of them. And by the way, just a footnote to all this, I think as we progress, you'll see the left in some ways just recalibrate their legal strategy, putting more emphasis on state Supreme Courts and state constitutions.
Right.
But to the extent that a lot of this still ends up in the Supreme Court, you're going to see the left push for legislation to radically change the court
right.
in terms of adding seats and a campaign of political delegitimization. And, of course, there's never an end. If Democrats add two more seats, you'll see Republicans add seats. The Democrats are facing a choice, I think. It's funny, that, by the way, that they're raising these suggestions at a time when they don't actually control the presidency. Like, why they would go around saying to in the era of a Republican president, hey, the next Democratic president should add seats, I think only gives President Trump ideas on what he could do if he wins re-election and wins back Congress. But the point I just want to say is that Democrats really face a choice. Do they want to open the door to adding more and more seats to the court, or do they want to leave it as is? Because if they do add two seats, that is the beginning of a process, not an end of a process.
Right. Before you know it, we have the New Hampshire legislature.
Right.
530 judges. You know, it's interesting, Adam, you have at least a dozen Democrats running for president right now, and they're running on various different things. You know, Bernie Sanders is doing his thing. Jay Inslee is the governor of Washington, is running on one issue, and that's climate change. I haven't heard much in the way of judges because, you know, there's a serious issue coming up in 2020, just as in 2016, and that there are two judges who very likely will not be around for the next, you know, through the next presidency if somebody replaces Trump in 2021, and that is Ruth Bader Ginsburg and Stephen Breyer.
Well, and by the way, in addition to those two, and people mostly focus on Ginsburg.
Clarence Thomas would be a third.
Well, or Samuel Alito. I think that right. it's an open question how long either Thomas or Alito will want to stay on the court.
Funny you mention that, because I've wondered why Clarence Thomas, I don't know the man personally, I don't know his mindset about doing the job, but I've always wondered why he, long wondered why he is not stepping down right now when he has a Republican Senate and a Republican president to choose a replacement he would like.
Well, he and people around him have downplayed rumors of a departure at the end of the term. I think we ought to just keep an eye out and see how things play out at
He's
the end
in
of
his,
the term.
What is he, in his early 70s?
Yeah, he was put on the
very
court.
Very young man when he was put
right,
on
he was put on the court very young. And quite frankly, out of all the justices, save for maybe Alito,
right.
Thomas seems to need this job less than anybody else. He's been very, throughout his life, he's been right. very, very comfortable. Let me put it this way. His life, as he sees it, is not defined by being a Supreme Court justice. Mm-hmm. He's very happy to get in his RV in the summer and tour the country with his wife,
right.
and then go watch Nebraska football games.
Right.
Maybe the only thing I disagree with over Justice Thomas is his choice of Nebraska football, being an Iowa Hawkeye. But anyway, you could very easily see Thomas sort of riding off into the sunset with an RV.
Right, but the Bush 43 judges are not going anywhere anytime soon.
Right.
The Clinton judges are coming to the end of their time. Breyer and Ginsburg have been on that court for 25 years almost.
Right.
Yeah.
You know, the President Trump's move to publish a list of prospective judicial nominees, mm-hmm. that was revolutionary. And I think it's hard to imagine any serious Republican presidential contender not doing that in future primaries. That's, I think right. it's going to be a permanent feature of Republican yeah. primaries. It'll be interesting to see whether Democrats imitate that. And I think whether they do or do not imitate that is a reflection of how confident they are that their judges have mainstream political attraction. Obviously, President Trump was not, and you know, his supporters, especially among the Federal Society and Heritage folks who helped with judicial nominations, they've always been confident that conservative judges are an attractive political argument.
Yes.
It's not as clear that liberal judges are, outside of maybe questions of abortion where the public's views are blurrier on their views of Roe v. Wade and so on. And But by and large, on other issues, it's not obvious that liberal judges are a popular mainstream political issue. So it'll be interesting to see in the primaries and then in the general election whether the Democratic contenders and the ultimate Democratic nominee formulate their own list of prospective judges, like Teo Cuellar and Goodwin Liu on the California Supreme Court, and other judges across the country. It'll be interesting to see if Kamala Harris tries to get out ahead of her colleagues in the primaries by identifying the judges that she would want to put on the court.
Well, it's a natural segue into issues Democrats care dearly about. But you're right, the polling shows that conservative voters get more jazzed by Supreme Court talk than liberals. You've looked at the docket for 2019.
Yeah.
Let's talk briefly about a couple of issues you see coming up that that caught your attention.
Sure. Well, given that I run a program called the Center for the Study of the Administrative State, the first case I have to start with is called Kaiser versus Wilkie. Mm-hmm. It's a case involving a veteran, his claim for disability benefits for post-traumatic stress disorder. Mm-hmm. But the case really isn't about that. The case is about the extent to which the courts should defer to the VA's interpretation of its own regulations. Mm-hmm. This is a doctrine called Seminole Rock deference, or our deference, not O-U-R, but A-U-E-R. It's the doctrine under which federal judges, including the Supreme Court, give utmost deference to an agency's interpretation of its own regulations. This is, for a long time, an uncontroversial doctrine. Justice Scalia actually wrote the unanimous opinion for the court in the mid-90s reaffirming this doctrine. But in 2011, Justice Scalia started raising doubts about this doctrine, hit second thoughts. He said, in a country that values and is based upon a separation of powers, there's something a little bit unnerving about a doctrine that has the same part of government writing, enforcing, and interpreting a law. The agency writes its regulation, the agency enforces its regulation, and the agency, more than the courts, is interpreting the regulation. Mm-hmm. Scalia said, this raises a number of questions, but there is, in terms of agency strategy and the way they write regulations, but as a matter of first principles, the court ought to back away from this doctrine. And that doctrine, that criticism has really taken on steam in the almost decade that's followed. There's been no shortage of law review articles and books and opinions from his colleagues supporting him on this. So everybody in my little world of administrative law and the separation of powers is keeping an eye on this case to see what the court does with it. It's going to be argued later in March, so the oral arguments will be very interesting to administrative law nerds like me. But it's not just a question of administrative law. It is a question of our structural constitution and the separation of powers. And it'll be seen in some ways as a precursor to challenges coming later to the doctrine of Chevron deference, which is where the agencies get deference not for interpreting their own regulations, but for interpreting the statutes that Congress passes. Mm-hmm. So that's an important case. A couple other cases that are on the court's docket that haven't been decided yet. One is called Nick versus Township of Scott. It has to do with eminent domain and the extent to which landowners need to go through onerous, sometimes never-ending state procedures before going to federal court trying to enforce the Fifth Amendment's protection of your right against having your property taken without just compensation.
Okay.
And so for a long time, the Supreme Court has said you need to exhaust the entire process at the state level before you can get to the federal courts because, after all, you don't have a right to block the government from taking your property. You just have a right to compensation. And so the theory was, well, wait to see what the state process does with you and how much money you get before you have a viable federal constitutional claim. Mm-hmm. But now there's some increasing skepticism of that doctrine, given how states and localities have gotten so good at creating procedural hoops and never-ending journeys of process, trying to keep you out of federal court altogether. Mm-hmm. So in the same way that the Supreme Court really opened the door to more challenges to federal regulation, especially with the EPA, in a case called Sackett a few years ago involving wetlands regulations, it seems the court might open the door to more preemptive litigation over local governments and state governments taking your property. Another case to keep an eye on is the litigation in the Supreme Court involving World War I memorial crosses.
World War I memorial crosses.
Yeah, that's right. World War I memorials that use crosses as the image of memorial.
Okay.
Right? Like at Flanders Field in Europe. Over the years, you've seen groups, especially pro-atheist groups like American Atheists, And other groups like I think Americans United for Separation of Church and State has been involved with this.
Yeah, we've had issues here in California where large crosses are erected on hillsides above highways and some group objects to having the cross.
Right, and there's a couple of those cases in the Supreme Court right now. They're awaiting decision. These do raise basic questions about what is the symbolic meaning of a cross. Mm-hmm. And I'll be honest, as a Catholic, I have mixed views on this, right?
Right?
On the one hand, I recognize that the cross has for a long time been a generic symbol of memorial to somebody who's died. At the same time, as a Catholic, as a Christian, you know, I recognize that the cross has a unique and important, profoundly important symbolic meaning. And so the court has to grapple with what's the meaning conveyed by these crosses, what's the role of the government in either owning the property the cross is on, maintaining the cross, and so on, and to what extent does that exercise of government power
right.
constitute an establishment of religion? And so these are very difficult questions. If I recall correctly, Justice Gorsuch had the opportunity to weigh in on this a little bit when he was a lower court judge on the Tenth Circuit.
Mm-hmm.
But I think this will be a very important case. And it is complicated. Again, I think while I'm a proponent for these sorts of displays, I think it's good that we recognize fallen soldiers, fallen state troopers who die in the line of duty, and so
right.
on, and that a cross is a natural memorial symbol. If you drive down the highway at 80 miles an hour and you see a cross on the side of the road, your first instinct is not going to be, this is religious proselytization.
Mm-hmm.
Your first instinct is going to be, oh, somebody died at that scene in a car crash or was a state
right.
trooper who was shot. But these are extremely complicated questions. I'll be interested to see how the court grapples with it. And as always, it'll be interesting to see on all these cases Chief Justice Roberts' role sort of in the middle of it all.
A very quick question. Is the issue having a cross on public or government property?
Right. Right. And sometimes these are crosses that were originally on private property that was later conveyed
right.
to government land.
Then yeah. what would you do in a military? Would this also apply to a military cemetery?
So I guess your question, is this a case where military cemeteries could be like declared unconstitutional as a result of the court's decision?
Well, I'm thinking, for example, if you go to the D-Day Cemetery
right.
Above Omaha Beach.
Right.
And it's just chock full of American crosses, and it's chock full of crosses with Stars of David.
Right.
All sorts of religious representations.
Yeah, I wrote about this actually years ago when I was in private practice. About a decade or more ago, I had an amicus brief and a case. Where I actually had, I think, photographs of Flanders Field
right.
where they had crosses. And it's interesting, for a lot of these military cemeteries and memorials, the family of the given soldier is allowed to choose sort of what the symbol is, whether it's a cross, a Star of David, and so on.
Mm-hmm.
But oftentimes the cross is the default if there isn't a choice by the family. Again,
right.
reflecting its role not just as a Christian symbol.
The body lies here. Right,
right. But, right. But just reflecting sort of the non-religious symbol. I don't think, and I sure hope, that military memorials and cemeteries are not at risk here, especially when you have crosses identifying individual gravestones. And I think that's what you're talking about, right?
Yes,
is we have
yes.
rows and rows of grave markers, and many or most of them are crosses.
Right.
There where you have each one attached to an individual whose family was given a choice
mm-hmm.
of the sign, there it's really less of a government action. Where
right.
where the government is using the cross sort of as a wholesale memorial, right?
Right.
Not at the retail level of individual veterans and individual state troopers at the state level, but rather where you have sort of a large cross.
Yeah.
This case could actually pose a threat to those, you know, nationwide, those large cross memorials.
So complicated. If you go to Arlington National Cemetery and you go to John Kennedy's resting place, and John Kennedy has a slab on the ground, which I think has a cross on it, by the
right.
way.
Right.
He's Catholic.
Right.
And then you walk to the left and you go by Bobby Kennedy's gravesite, and then further to the left, Ted Kennedy's. What do you see? Simple white crosses.
Yeah.
And I don't know if those are expressions of Catholicism or just, I think what they're actually going for is just quiet dignity that here lies a person.
Yeah, although of course with the yeah. Kennedy family and its famous, if nominal, Catholicism.
This is a whole other podcast to
right.
get into, the Kennedys and religion.
Right.
Let me ask you two final questions, Adam.
Yeah.
First question, these two cases and others coming forward, you know more about the court than I do, obviously. Is it naive for someone like me to assume that everything starts as a 4-4-1 split, or is everything a jump ball in this court? Now, in other words, when a case comes before the Supreme Court, can it be 9-0-8-1, or do I assume that, geez, there are four judges automatically disposed one way and four the other way, and here's John Roberts in the middle?
Okay, so most cases that come before the court are not 5-4 cases. Most cases of the court, which are of relatively mundane matters, where the court is just clarifying a complicated area of law,
right,
you're going to get either 9-0 decisions or broad sort of cross-ideological divisions. Right. And also it's important to keep in mind that most of what the Supreme Court does is say, no, we're not going to hear a case at all.
Right.
And that means that those are cases where at least six of the judges agree that the case shouldn't be heard. But, of course, on the hot-button issues, it's inevitable with this court that we're looking at basically 4-1-4. Now, of course, we used to look at 4-1-4, and it was the liberals and Kennedy in the middle, and then Roberts with three other conservatives on the right. Mm-hmm. Before Kennedy, it was the liberals with O'Connor in the middle.
Right.
This is, I guess, an inevitable feature of the way we look at the courts. I'd think of it in terms of 4-1-4, not just in terms of judicial ideology, mm-hmm, but also Roberts' unique sort of viewpoint of the institutional role of the court. Mm-hmm. It's an interesting moment where for the first time in a long time, the so-called swing justice, and I wouldn't call Roberts a swing justice, but the justice in the middle happens to be the chief justice. You know, we take for granted, we refer to courts of different eras as the Marshall Court, the Taney Court, the Taft Court,
right,
the Warren Court, the Rehnquist Court, the Roberts Court, and so on. But for a long time, this court was the Kennedy Court. And for the first time, it really is the Roberts Court. Mm-hmm. And that institutional role, that institutional viewpoint, Roberts' view of the court's proper role in the country and the Chief Justice's proper role on the court becomes important. This happens to be something I'm spending a lot of time thinking about, not with respect to Roberts specifically, but with respect to the history of Chief Justices generally. A couple of weeks ago, I delivered a paper at a conference on the 200th anniversary of McCulloch versus Maryland, mm-hmm, the famous and really fundamentally important case where the Supreme Court in 1819 declared constitutional the Bank of the United States. And there's a book coming out with a number of authors all looking at different aspects of the case, and I was invited to write a chapter on John Marshall and judicial statesmanship. Mm-hmm. And I've been giving a lot of thought to what is judicial statesmanship, what is statesmanship in general,
right,
what's the judicial variant of it, to what extent did Marshall exhibit this in that case. Mm-hmm. And it's something I'm thinking about much more broadly about chief justices across the board. The chief justice is a unique, little singular office in this country in terms of an intersection of law, politics, and statesmanship. Mm-hmm. James Madison in Federalist 51 said that we would have separated powers with ambition counteracting ambition, and the interests of the man must always be connected to the constitutional rights of the place. And for no one more than the Chief Justice is that true, not just for Roberts, mm-hmm, but all of his predecessors. And so I've enjoyed sort of commencing some work on this, and I hope to be writing a lot more on it in the years to come.
So final question, Adam. You work at the Antonin Scalia Law School.
Right.
If I asked you to give a lecture on Antonin Scalia, I've got a pretty good idea what you would talk about. You would talk a bit about Nino Scalia, the man.
Yeah.
And just what an interesting, complicated guy he was, and just kind of a bon vivant, and just lived very large.
Yeah.
You would maybe talk about a different era in Washington. I believe Scalia was unanimously confirmed, like 97-0.
98-0, and the other two that weren't there, I think, were both Republicans.
Exactly. So unanimously confirmed. And then you would talk about his views and his actions on the court. I don't want you to give me the legacy of John Roberts, because he's only been on the job for 14 years, and as we talked about earlier, he's maybe halfway through this.
Right.
But if you were tasked with just writing the lead, if Roberts were to announce tomorrow that he is stepping down as Chief Justice, and I asked you, Adam White, reporter, to write the lead on his stepping down, what goes in that opening paragraph about him?
Well, I do want to say, since you asked about Scalia, one of the real pleasures that I have at teaching at the Scalia Law School is I teach a semester-long seminar on Scalia.
The man himself.
Where we will look at so much of his writings and try to make connections across things. If Roberts were to step down tomorrow, of course the lead would be, holy smokes, Chief Justice Roberts stepped down a lot sooner than we did.
Right.
I'd say the first line in Roberts' professional obituary will, of course, be Chief Justice Roberts, who frustrated conservatives
by voting for Obamacare
by twice voting in favor of Obamacare and its implementation. I think that's key. But I'd say if Roberts continues on this current trajectory and he stays on the court for a few more years, I think in addition to that, people will pay attention to his pattern of taking small nibbles at doctrines before ultimately having the court come through with a more controversial decision. He did that on the Voting Rights Act. He did that on union issues and so on. You've seen Roberts again and again start off by seeking 7-2 decisions where possible, little nibbles, right, before really teeing up the question and having a more ideological opinion. I think that trend will continue with Roberts now that he really is in full, much more control of the court.
Right.
And I think we'll see that play out in the years to come.
So it's the Roberts Court, not the Warren Court.
That's right. It is, for the very first time, finally, truly the Roberts Court.
Right. Adam White enjoyed the conversation.
Well, likewise.
You've been listening to Area 45, a Hoover Institution podcast on the policy avenues available to the 45th President of the United States, and in this case, the 17th Chief Justice of the United States Supreme Court. If you've been enjoying Area 45, please don't forget to rate, review, and subscribe to us on iTunes. And if you wouldn't mind, please spread the word. Convince your friends to have a listen. Adam White has a podcast, the name of which is
Reasonable Disagreements with Richard Epstein.
Also available on iTunes, I assume?
Yes, absolutely.
Yes, get it, download it, spread it around. The Hoover Institution is online at www.hoover.org. While you're there, do yourself a favor and sign up for the Daily Report, the Hoover Daily Report, which delivers the best work of Adam White and his Hoover colleagues to your inbox weekdays. The Hoover Institution has Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter feeds. Our Twitter handle is @HooverInst. That's @HooverInst. Adam White is on Twitter. God help you. His Twitter handle is @AdamJWhiteDC. That, again, is @AdamJWhiteDC. For the Hoover Institution, this is Bill Whalen. We'll be back soon with another installment of Area 45. Until then, take care. Thanks for listening.
For more podcasts from the Hoover Institution, please visit hoover.org or Hoover's channels on all major podcast platforms, including Apple, Google, Podbean, Stitcher, SoundCloud, and Spotify. I'm Chris Dauer for the Hoover Institution. Thanks for listening.